about time for us to start the session. So I think we should. And if we're in the right place, this should be session. I'm supposed to say which session it is. I don't know if they have numbers on them this time, huh? Okay, session number 163. And I'm pleased to be able to introduce our speaker for this session, the session titled being Maturity, Meaning, and Mormonism. And right along with our theme this year. This is a special treat to hear regarding from Mr. Lowell Lemassani. I think hopefully I said that correct.
Perfect.
I've been practicing it for a few minutes. Our speaker has been for 33 years a financial planner. He's been a farmer, a rancher, a scientist, a soldier. I wanted to put, baker, chief, everything else. A businessman, lay minister, and student of psychology. He's been a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for 42 years. A convert when he was in college. And we have that in common because so was I. It was on what the fields today, like it was 42 years, but not quite. And right now he's active in his ward with his, he works with the deacons, and he must be young at heart to want to work with them. That's wonderful. His hobbies are psychology, religion, and fly fishing. Not necessarily in that order. We'll turn the time now over to him, and if there's time left over, we'll have some questions, but we'll turn the time now over to Mr. Lemassani. Okay, Sammy. Okay.
My daughter Sarah is passing out some flyers. You should be getting three pages. If you're missing a page, let her know. I'm going to move this real quick before I start. My next-door neighbor is a great guy. His parents, who visit every summer when the grandkids are out of school, are wonderful folks too. But for some reason, my neighbor's good-natured wife is on Prozac the entire length of their visit. She never touches the stuff the rest of the year. It turns out that Grandpa and Grandma always have a ton of ideas and suggestions on how she could be a better mother and wife. My home teacher is a wonderful person. He brings his wife when he visits, and we like to just sit and talk with them because they're so interesting and they're so easy to talk to. Their daughter just got married in the temple. They had nothing to do with the wedding, financially or otherwise. Dad didn't attend. Mom went for the sealing, but not for the breakfast or the receptions. Turns out they didn't think the groom was worthy enough. So they campaigned mightily against the marriage and created this huge rift in the family. My wife and I thought the young couple was very sweet together, that they had been faithfully in dating for 4 years, were well matched, and very patient, waiting for everybody to agree that they should be married. I, of course, could see the mistakes of the father, especially, and I was amazed at the incredibly high standards he measured his new son-in-law against. This made me feel very insightful and somewhat superior to the errant father-in-law. It may not surprise you to find out that in a matter of a couple days after experiencing this insight of my superiority, that I was embroiled in a nasty battle of words with my own daughter over her slovenly approach to choosing a college. She was sobbing, crying, and yelling that I was terribly overbearing, and I was thinking that my home teacher probably felt just like me, that no matter what you try to do for a child, they are never grateful and always break your heart. My good friend and co-fellow worker in scouting is one great guy, too. He's the kind of guy you would love to hate because he overachieves in everything he does. He's incredibly smart and talented. He doesn't lack for income or toys. And yet, he is so humble and engaging that you just can't help but really liking the guy. He has a daughter that broke his heart, too. After being a model child in most every way in high school, she went to college and stunned her parents by eventually moving in with her LDS boyfriend. Unlike my home teachers, these folks were models of love, support, patience, and respect for their daughter and her lover. And after almost 3 years of breaking their hearts, the daughter saw the mistake she had made, coming to the conclusion that her boyfriend was pretty vain and selfish, and she changed her ways to the point of qualifying to return to the temple. Her parents were thrilled. The daughter then met a returned missionary, and they became quite close. The father of the returned missionary found out the girl's history from his son and went absolutely berserk, tried everything he could to break them up, took his car, talked to the girl's bishop, his son's bishop, his bishop, the parents of the daughter's bishop, my friend's bishop, to the parents, everything to break this up. And the reason he said this had to be done was because his son was destined to be a great leader in the church. He had a patriarchal blessing that said so. And marrying this non-virgin would derail his son's chances of being a general authority. Now, it seems that parents often have great fear for their children and feel they have to intervene in children's lives to help them make the correct choices. Tolerance for mistakes or lethargy in making decisions is not allowed. Why, as we mature, do we get overly concerned with the choices of the next generation? Why do we feel we need to get so involved? Do we forget our own past? I can still recall some of the rancor I experienced when my parents seemed to be too intrusive. Even the venerable psychologist Carl Jung liked to quote Voltaire when he reminded his mature patients that the mission of the latter half of life is to tend your own garden. That sounds like a polite way to say mind your own business, but I think he meant more than that. Let's examine this just a little more closely. Choice, or more properly, free agency, seems to be at the heart of this issue. Let's look a bit closer at my home teacher's situation. The parents had their standards regarding their daughter's choice of a husband. There's nothing wrong with the parents' high standards. They have the free agency to choose whatever standards they wish. But if they fail to discern between their standards or their choices, an accurate perspective of all the choices available to their daughter, they're heading for trouble. We can look at the one chart that you have, and if we envision this choice of mates as a long line and see the good on the right with an ideal matchup on the far right end, and the wrong on the left with the worst possible choice at the far left, we get a field of choices that looks like this. I'm going to move over here. Is this one working? Sounds like it. Right here on the top line, we talk about the choice of a mate or a choice of a husband for this girl. And here is the proverbial center point with four choices moving towards the left, Sunstone tradition, and good choices moving towards the right. Okay. Then we get this feeling for the field of possible choices. The parents may be away over here. That's fine as long as they understand that. The daughter, frankly, I think, from my perspective, who knows how accurate that is, made a good choice. But if the parents' perception is that the only allowable choices are to the right of what they say, then they see the line like this. We see that on your sheet of paper. They're kind of in the middle. Anything that's good is going to be this way. Anything this way is going to be a poor choice, tending towards evil or a big mistake. So they see their daughter to the left of their choice. She's not making a good choice here. It's dangerous, going to cause her some real grief. But the good way is to the right of what they choose or where they choose. Everybody get that concept? The problem there being not that the parents have these standards. I personally never found a young man that was good enough for any of my daughters. But they have to realize that that's where their perspective was. Questions on that? We'll come back to some of this. When we don't understand where our perspective is, this creates heartache and misery for everyone. But there are even larger issues here than just perspective. We as Mormons are concerned with making correct choices, as well as we should be, but we often have a very simplistic approach to the issue of free agency and choice. We tend to make an exhaustive list of opposites, and then we take our moral pencil and begin checking off our choices and our accomplishments. On your sheet, on the middle of that first sheet that has this choice of husband chart on it, you'll see a small list of some choices that I made for myself personally. And one way we might deal with those is to go down and say, oh yes, I'm a wise person, I'm knowledgeable, I'm a non-smoker, I'm a teetotaler, well, we'll skip the next one, I'm loving, I'm happy, so forth, and we'll look at those and kind of get a feeling for where we are, where we fit there. And we can spend our lives checking this list in our own heads and accounting for our choices. The problem is, these individual choices don't exist in a vacuum. They are not isolated from other choices. Once again, we will revisit this with my home teacher in his situation. There is more than one issue here. The choice of a mate is just one part of this situation. How about the issue of respect or disdain for the daughter's feelings and her thoughts? How about issues in love and support versus the withdrawal of these things to their daughter? Most critically, how about the really big issue of free agency? Whose choice is this anyway? If I as a parent put all my energy and effort into cajoling, bribing, compelling, or literally forcing my daughter to make a certain choice, where do I stand on the issue of free agency? What respect am I showing for free agency? Has my unrelenting obstinacy with one aspect of choice pushed me well into the camp of poor or evil choices in other, possibly more important choices? Edward Emminger, a famous disciple of Carl Jung, speaks about man becoming aware of the concept of opposition in all things. He says that once this concept becomes conscious, the opposites split apart, kind of like we have on this little chart here, and the individual ego is confronted with conflict. Then there arises the crucial question of whether the ego is able to contain the conflict of opposites as a psychological problem to be met with consciousness. Unfortunately, that task is very difficult, even to that. You might say that if we are able to keep the conflict as our own, we keep the problem in our own garden, so to speak, so we can tend to it there. Carl Jung says, opposites are of God. Therefore, man must bend to this burden. Sounds to me kind of like bending over in your garden doing the work. And in so doing, he finds that God, in his oppositeness, has taken possession of him, incarnated himself in him. He becomes a vessel filled with divine conflict. Edinger states that what usually happens is that the individual is not able to contain this warring within one's own self, and the conflict of opposite spills out into the outer world by way of projection. And it is then that the constellated opposites live themselves out not in the vessel of the individual psyche, but in the vessel of society as a whole. Yes, sir?
Your microphone, when you get a little too close, it kind of has some feedback. I wonder if you could just pull back.
So I'm too close instead of too far away. Is that better?
Yeah, when you're a little farther away, that's better.
All right.
Thanks.
If I bump my nose on it, I don't know I'm getting too close. Okay. Where are we now? And I would add that it breaks out not only in society, but all levels of society, from individual relationships between two people to families and on up the scale, through cultures and nations. Let's go back to our home teacher one more time. Had he been able to take the strong reaction that he had toward his daughter's choice of a marriage partner and say to himself, get that? This is really challenging my perspective of what I wish for my daughter, and this could affect so many issues between my daughter and my wife and I that I must find a way to resolve this conflict that is flaring up in my soul. I need to figure out my priorities, sort out my feelings, and come to a point where I can be at peace again. Had he kept this conflict within his own vessel or within his own garden, things may have progressed quite differently, and the results may have been more harmonious. Let me go back to my own dilemma with my daughter and her college choices. After fussing around and brooding for about a week and a half, I came to the realization that I was projecting my own excitement about her college choices onto her, and I was pushing my own anxiety out onto her. It was a very difficult and humbling, almost humiliating experience to realize what I was doing. I asked myself if she would really benefit if she didn't go through this process on her own and learn from her own experience. The answer was obvious. I apologized to her, and then I wrote a letter and told her how happy I was for her, that she had prepared for this moment of her life so well and had so many great opportunities. I shared with her some experiences that I had when I was her age and told her I hoped this would help her understand me better and that it might help her to understand herself more too. This action calmed me and let me feel good about that I had shared my excitement and joy with her and that I had addressed my own experiences that caused anxiety to me and had shared them in a non-confrontational, non-obtrusive way. My daughter was genuinely grateful, and as I speak, she's just boarding the plane from Boston, where she toured 4 colleges to get an idea of what might work in the Boston area. That had a good outcome to it after I calmed down and got my perspectives and priorities straight. I quoted some interesting remarks from Carl Jung earlier in this presentation. Jung stated that opposites are of God, and he used the phrase God in his oppositeness. Now, does this jive with doctrines of the LDS Church? I went to 2 Nephi, chapter 2, verse 11 says, "For it must needs be that there is an opposition in all things. If not so, righteousness could not be brought to pass, neither wickedness, neither holiness, nor misery, neither good nor bad. Wherefore, all things must be a compound in one." Verse 15 says, "And to bring about his eternal purposes in the end of man, after he had created our first parents and the beasts of the field and the fowls of the air, and in fine all things which are created, it must needs be that there was an opposition, even the forbidden fruit in opposition to the tree of life, that one being sweet and the other being bitter. The very first business of man, after his world was created and he was created, was to begin the process of dealing with the concept of opposition in all things." How much clearer can Scripture be? Jung and LDS Scripture are in complete harmony on this subject. Not only was opposites of God, as Jung stated, but they were a very high priority with God. Jung goes on to say in other sources, "For just as there is no energy without the tension of opposites, so there can be no consciousness without the perception of differences. But any stronger emphasis of differences leads to polarity and finally to a conflict which maintains the necessary tension of opposites. This tension is needed on one hand for increased energy." We all have our priorities and our desires and our needs and the things that we fear and hope for and so forth that involve some kind of internal conflict or internal choices that we have to make. That's pretty obvious. For increased energy, and on the other side, for further development of consciousness. In other words, as we make these choices, Jung says we become more conscious, more aware of our life and what's going on there. But although this conflict is unquestionably useful, it also has very evident disadvantages, which sometimes prove injurious. Again, in 2 Nephi chapter 2, verse 13, it says about opposition, "If these things are not, there is no God. Wherefore, all things must have vanished away." Scripture also speaks of the injurious disadvantages in this conflict, verse 27, where it says, "Men are free to choose liberty and eternal life through the great mediator of all men, or choose captivity and death according to the captivity and power of the devil. For he seeketh that all men might be miserable like unto himself." Injurious disadvantages indeed. So it doesn't sound as if the process of dealing with opposition is something that we can just go check off on a little list and be done with. Please understand me, I'm not saying that isn't a good thing to be involved in, is evaluating yourself against your life choices and what you consider to be right and wrong. That's a great idea. But there's more to it again than that. It seems to be a necessary conflict for the creation of awareness and vitality and meaning in our lives. So when Carl Jung talks about tending one's garden, he is referring to are attending to the conflicts that arise in our Garden of Eden, our own personal Garden of Eden. We literally have the dilemma that Adam and Eve had relived in our lives many times over, where we have these conflicting choices. We obey one and transgress oftentimes another. Jung says there are three ways to deal with opposition. I'm going to come out front again. You have a chart with you, one that's empty and one that has a whole bunch of busyness on it for me. And we're going to talk about this chart. I've got some rudimentary parts of it up here on the board as well. Carl Jung says there are three ways to deal with opposition. If we take the concept of good, he says we can experience good. That's kind of a passive experience. It can happen without anyone, any active involvement beyond the experience itself. The sun shines, we feel the warmth, we see the light, we breathe fresh air, and our lungs are invigorated. We can choose, the second choice, the second way to deal with opposition is we can choose good, or consciously make an effort to be involved in good things, or in creating good. We can choose to love, to serve, to teach, to be happy. We also have tendency as human beings to get caught up in goodness. Jung calls it the participation mystique, where we identify with goodness and see it as what we are, or naturally what we do. We are good, we are righteous, we always make the right choices. We are the ward genealogy specialist, we are the person that should be the bishop. Whatever the case may be, we put ourselves way over on that side of the spectrum. And at the extreme, we see ourselves as incapable of doing anything but good, and we see ourselves as chosen or holy, or even as saviors. We literally become like God or Christ or at least one of their angels. Some examples of that in history might be David Koresh of the Branch Davidian Waco, Texas fame, Marshall Applewhite of Heaven's Gates fame, James Jones of Jonestown, Guyana fame. Even Adolf Hitler, in some respects, may have been someone who thought he was too good. He thought of himself as the savior of mankind, at least a certain part of him. We'll come back to that a little bit later. The opposite of good or evil has the same spectrum of potential. We can experience evil, we can choose evil, and even identify with evil. So we have the spectrum of these choices. I don't have them up here, do I? No. It's on your paper. Where we have those three experiences. Now we can effectively illustrate this by making this circle and show it on this illustration. We can take a vertical line and cut our circle in half, showing evil on the bottom and good on the top. We can run a horizontal line through the circle and say this is a passive approach and this is an active approach. Okay? Then we can diagram some of the choices that we have, experience being one choice, a passive approach. Choice, being maybe more of a balance. And then if we go too far and becoming too involved or too identified, we go into the identity part of the circle. Same thing is true with evil. We experience evil, we can choose evil, and we can identify with evil. Now God allows some of these things to happen. He says we have, and probably should, experience some of these things to what degree. What sections of this circle of these six potentials does God allow? I mean, we can do them all, but which ones does he say, well, this is something that I allow to happen to you? Is it just these three up here? Identifying, choosing, and experiencing good? I get ahead and check you know. Obviously, we're allowed to experience evil as well. He gets a little upset with us if we get down into these quadrants. We forfeit some things. We get there. If we go to these choices and look at those, okay, let's talk just a little bit about some of the feelings and some of the concepts that are involved there. You notice that I have good and evil meeting in two places. One over here is kind of the Lord's doing. He doesn't create evil, he doesn't push us into evil, but he allows evil to happen to us. So we can cross that border there when the Lord allows that to happen. Certainly there have been some tremendous cases
in the history of mankind where evil has been experienced by man out of his own control. So oftentimes when we're over in this side of the spectrum, things are kind of out of our control. I don't control the sunrise. I don't control the temperature outside of my house. My wife and daughter over here, they say, I don't control it inside. So there's things here that are out of our control that we can't deal with. Over here, we're trying to literally control it all. We want to be in charge. We feel overburdened over here. I'm the ward genealogist. I'm the only person in the ward that has any interest in genealogy. I'm the only one that keeps the Lord from coming down and destroying our ward for lack of interest, because I'm the one doing all this. It's just such a burden. And then when we get released, we're shocked that the bishop would let us go, because who else can do this? Nobody else knows it. Everybody else is an idiot. Those kind of feelings when you're starting to push that counter over here. If it gets to the point of where you literally think that you are called to save people in some way or other, like a David Koresh, then you start to go down in here and say, well, I will force people, I will trick people, I will deceive people to do good, and you cross that line. So the Lord will allow us to have feelings of passion and interest and great joy in doing some things that are identifying with people, feeling that feeling. As long as we stay on this side of the line, it will allow us to feel great evil if we are passively involved in it. Viktor Frankl, who was in World War II, a prisoner of, not a prisoner of war, but a Jewish prisoner in the concentration camps, interestingly, was probably deep into this, where he was experienced great evil. And yet, he had a good heart, a joyful countenance, and loved the people who were torturing him and mistreating him. The reason being is his perspective stayed here. So we experience along this circle everywhere, but our perspective should try to be centered. This is the point where we have the peace and the control. A lot of folks think that great joy in life comes from kind of hitting this sweet spot right here, where we're partly passive, partly active, making all the choices, and that's what makes us extremely happy and peaceful. Well, if that were true, Viktor Frankl, when he was doing this stuff down here, couldn't have felt the peace and the joy and the love that he had for his fellow human beings that were torturing him down in this area, because he was definitely there. But since his perspective, his awareness of what could go on in his life was centered in the center, where he could see this whole spectrum, he was fine, in a way. Because he was obviously not. Yes?
One of the things that kept Viktor Frankl centered was a tree. And this tree blossomed in the springtime. And, of course, the blossoms fell off, and there were leaves on it, and then barren branches in the wintertime. But I've always thought that that tree was a first thing he looked at in the morning, and I've always thought that tree, because it was grounded, because it was there, and I've always felt that that tree had a lot to do with keeping him grounded, reminding him who he was, and that outside forces should not allow outside forces to affect him in an evil way, like the people around him. So that's just my thinking.
I think that's a wonderful way to put it, a very wonderful way to put it. The question, obvious question that comes into my mind is, how do we stay here with our perspective? Probably none of us manage to stay in the very center. If we're really good at this, we might be able to circle around that center to some degree. If not, our perspective can get back out here onto the extremes of this circle, and that's when we create problems. We go back to my home teacher, who had this choice for his daughter, what kind of a mate that she should have. And like I say, he could have that standard as long as his perspective of what's real is here. He's fine. If he moves over here, he gets into trouble. One way we can describe this situation is to look at all of these experiences that happen in our lives and look at this center and say that the perspective that we have is hooked by little rubber bands to all of these life experiences.
As long as our perspective is centered, all the rubber bands have that same tension, and there's no instability there. If we move our perspective over here, I'm the war genealogist. I've got to do it all. Nobody else knows a thing. They're all a bunch of idiots. I am stretching the bands down here so badly that when I get released, I go to the opposite. Now I'm a victim of the bishop. I've done all this work. I've done all this preparation. He's taken away my authority. He's taken away the calling that I worked so hard at. I'm never going to take another calling in your church for the rest of my life. He's not going to set me up for that disappointment again. Whatever the case. I've never had a genealogist that felt that way, but that's just an example I wanted to bring out. But you can see what happens when we stretch our perspective and go over there. Then we have problems over here. I can see, just as I mentioned about my daughter, what a sloth she had been about choosing in college, that if I had kept that up, I wouldn't have been able to enjoy her college experience. There would always have been a gulf between her and I about school and education. And I might have then felt like, well, she's not appreciative of all that I did to help her. I'm a victim of her selfishness, her self-centeredness, whatever the case may be. So typically, when we don't maintain the tension of all of the choices that we have and keep a good perspective on it, we have a tendency to snap rubber bands or pull ourselves the other direction. Yes?
I seem to remember that Carl Jung said that when we're young, you know, we go outward toward things that we might be good at and develop ourselves and be brilliant in certain ways.
Sure.
But then we need balance. And so in the second half of our life, then we have to give everything else its due, kind of.
Sure.
Come back in.
I think the Lord, Carl Jung, understood that, wants us to have this range of experiences in our lives, wants us to feel all of these things, wants us to go out and develop our talents and our skills and our abilities and experience life from the standpoint of what are our goals, what are our priorities. But at some point, we have to reflect. In the business world, working in the investment world, I know dozens and dozens and dozens of men who take their life to this extreme as far as the definition of who they are. I'm a hard-charging businessman. I've created big corporations. I create wealth. I don't take any prisoners. I'm the tough guy. It comes time to retire. What do? Well, they play golf or something where they can keep score, okay, and keep winning, whatever the case may be. They do that same ultra-active, controlling approach, and they miss out on a lot of life experiences. They don't see the tree. They don't see the beauty in life. And so, yes, in early parts of our lives, we should develop the ability to swing that pendulum across this spectrum and be able to understand and deal with adversity, evil, difficulty in our lives as well. But don't get stuck, don't get the needle stuck, identifying in one place or the other. Certainly, we could go to the other side of things and say there are people we know that are the victim mentality. Well, you know, if the government was better and gave me all the things I needed, I wouldn't have all these problems. If I didn't have tuberculosis or black lung or whatever I might be suffering from here, I could achieve over here, so forth. So there's people on all sides of that spectrum that get stuck. And the longer we spend there, the further we go over there, the more we identify with one side or the other as the controlling factor in our lives, the more danger we're going to have of injury and inability to enjoy. Yes?
I'm curious how you would strike the balance. I mean, your daughter's college, those are choices more interest level. But when you get to the other side where they're making bad choices, I'll be extreme, using to sell drugs, how do you accept them without, you don't want to condone the behavior, but you don't want to push them away. How do you strike that kind of balance?
With a lot of prayer and reflection and care. I don't have a good answer for you. I'll give you a personal example. I had a son who got heavily involved in the drug scene to the point of where I was fearful that his life or my life was going to end. One of the episodes that happened with my son before I took some action was that he confronted me in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock, wanting some money. He wanted $15, which is kind of odd. And
I stood up in the dark bedroom where he was standing, and he had an 8-inch butcher knife in his hand. I am a former military person. My mind went right into here. I said, disarm or disable. That's the old military trick when you see an adversary. Fortunately, I had a nunchuck bar or whatever right by my desk. I just picked it up and said, you've got the knife, I've got this lead bar, do we really want to go at it? He threw the knife down and ran away. But at that particular instant, I made the decision that he had forfeited his free agency, that I was now going to do something. And we put him into a school where he had no money, no shoes, nothing but a uniform. He was basically in almost a prison environment as far as what he could do and where he could go. The school then taught him how to cope with life. It cost me a ton of money. It was incredibly difficult to do, and it saved his life. He's an anthropology major up at the school where I went, doing wonderfully well, and extremely thankful for the fact that I tricked him into doing this environment. So yeah, there are times when we look and say, you know, what do we do here? The thing that gave me the impetus was, my life is in danger, my wife's life is in danger, his life is in danger. I think we have to look at things from that standpoint. Over here, if it's a choice of a mate, my pride is in danger. Well, my pride has been smacked around several times before. I can take another hit. But when there's things where real risk is involved, I think that we have to evaluate it. It all comes back to trying as much as we can to keep the issue with us. What makes sense for us based on this whole picture? If somebody's threatening my life, then I may have to take their freedoms away. Or I have to kill them, but I may have to put them in a situation where they can't exercise their free agency until they're ready to make choices. Other comments? I hope this idea of studying opposition and free agency will help you have a more meaningful and mature understanding of this great life challenge, whether you are a Mormon or have other beliefs. I hope it will help you become more conscious, more creative, more receptive, and that you'll have a clear vision of obstacles that block enjoyment of life and opportunities that beckon you to enjoy your life. And I appreciate the opportunity to share this with you today. I'll open it up. I guess we have quite a little bit of time for some questions and comments and personal experiences if you'd like, whatever you'd like to share.
If you'd come to the microphone for your questions, then we can get them on the tape. Or experiences. Yeah. Come on up.
On this chart you've given us, you've got some emotions / feelings and some concepts. Could you address that, what that has to do with?
Sure. I skipped right over that. I'll take a moment or two and do that. Let me get this out of the way. See if I can find my copy of that. Yes, I listed several emotions and feelings. I think the feeling of anger can come probably on either extreme of that circle. If we're on the very passive side and bad things start to happen to us and we don't have control, that certainly generates anger. If we're in a real controlling mode, very passionate about something, really identified with something as that being us, and we start to feel the pressure of other people being idiots and not understanding how brilliant we are, then again we can get angry and step over that line and say, well, heck with them, or I'll fix them, or whatever the case may be. So anger can show up anywhere. Joy, I think, can show up anywhere along that. Viktor Frankl, I think, proved that. That it's an emotion that we're in charge of, we choose, and we can have a joyful countenance anywhere along that. But I think the true and lasting joy comes from the understanding that that's our life, to go across that spectrum of experience, to be balanced at times and feel real good about things, to be passionate about things at times and striving to accomplish things, to be passive and to see the tree and the beauty of nature and so forth. that if we, the more we can experience that spectrum, the greater possibility that our lives are going to be filled with joy. Effortlessness has a tendency to be something that comes up in the passive side. It's great when things are going so well we can coast. I never mind taking the foot off the gas and letting it roll downhill. Sweet spots, again, a lot of people perceive that sweet spot to be kind of that balance of active and passive. And I think if we look at our whole life, we want to maintain some kind of a balance of things that are passive and things where we're active and so forth, and being able to move across that spectrum. To bring all of our aspects of our life into that sweet spot, that sounds like too much work. I don't think I have the energy for that. If we're too passive, I think we get bored. If we're too active, we become burdened. We've discussed the concept of what's it means to be in control, how it feels to be in control, how it feels to be out of control. Passion, again, has a tendency to be more on the right-hand side. One thing I've not talked about is crossing over that line into choosing evil. I don't pretend to be an expert on the motivations and the thoughts that went through the mind of Adolf Hitler. He may have had a very difficult childhood. My understanding, there was certainly some problems there. And he may have come from some of the evil that he seemed to perpetrate from the standpoint of suffering and you know, wanting revenge and wanting to make up for some of the things that he perceived as happened to him in his life. I also think he came from the other side of wanting to be a savior of the Aryan race and to eliminate the bad guys. So he may have come at evil from both sides of that spectrum to some degree. An interesting person in that respect. Revenge, typically if we suffer a lot of evil in our own lives, that's when we get into that revenge mode, and I think that's when we have the potential to cross over and choose evil. We think it's something we're doing to get back, to get even, to make up for. The chosen one concept, I think I discussed that a little bit. Don't care. We can be passive. One of the difficulties, I was a very driven person for much of my younger years. My father told me I was an idiot. I'd never amount to anything. When I was 6 years old, he got his first paycheck for $1,000. He stuck it under my nose and said, "You'll never amount to enough to get a paycheck of this size." When I was 40 years old and I got my first net paycheck of $10,000, I went to his house and I stuck it under his nose. And I reminded him what he said to me when I was 6 years old. He had no recollection of it. I could remember it was like it was yesterday. He cried, and I said, "Good," because I cried for a long time tonight after he stuck that $1,000 paycheck under my nose. So I was driven by that. I internalized that, and it became a driving principle. Fortunately, I was able to let go of it. It helped to be able to get even with my dad, but what if I never had? It still would have been the burden that I put on myself, or let stay on myself. He might put it there, but I let it stay and let it grow. Where were we? Some of the concepts, identification versus passion. As I mentioned, my home teacher has every right to be passionate about what his daughter chooses in the way of a mate. Correct. Good for him. Teach good principles. Teach them to make good choices. That's wonderful. But the choice is ultimately hers. Teach free agency. Teach respect for each other. Teach love regardless of what choices we make. Those kind of things. We've talked about this concept of stretching. I think we got through that. And we all deal with the consequences when we step, when our perspective steps out of bounds and it becomes something that we identify with. Sometimes unknowingly, sometimes it becomes pretty something we're pretty conscious of. Other questions? Yes, sir.
I understand and agree with the concept of tending your own garden. I'm curious if you had any comments about, in the spirit of goodwill, if you had a friend or an acquaintance who was being extreme, being able to perhaps, in a good moment, maybe help them see how eccentric in this case you're describing them being, at the risk of ruining the relationship, in this case, I think, of his son or daughter. I realize, in a technical sense, of tending your own garden, at the same time, if you are in a position and feel like you can make a comment to this person and say, you know, if you consider what's going on, could you maybe address that, maybe in the light of this, or is it...
I'll make an attempt. I have two of my daughters here. Maybe they'd like... No, I'm not going to give them that chance. They might say too much. They got experimented on a lot when they were young. With my youngest daughter now, in this situation with college, she was petrified by the idea of making a choice. She didn't want to make a choice because if she chose a college that didn't accept her, she was going to be heartbroken. And if she chose one beneath her, she felt like she would have made a mistake and not lived up to her potential. I tried to give her advice. She was too nervous to upset. When I shared the story of the dilemmas I had when I was a young man and what happened as a result of my own choices, I think she got the message of what I was trying to say to her about her own situation. You know, just relax and make some choices, be happy with them, let the Lord open and close the doors. You've done all you can do. Had I said that to her verbally, I think she would have... You said, you relax. Leave me alone. But by just telling stories. So sometimes I think we can tell people things maybe by relating a story or by just listening or sharing something of our own difficulties. So yes, I think there are opportunities to help, to guide, to especially with children. Thank goodness my children are all very tolerant of all the silly mistakes I made. And I have a great relationship with all of them at this point. Hope to keep that up. Yes, ma'am.
I have a few things. And maybe all of you can help me. I want to tell you what I like.
Okay.
I like the center. And I like the idea of each person, the person in the bad spot and the person in the good spot, are in each a responsible position to pull each other to that center to be able to get a dialogue going, like you did giving your daughter the letter, like you took the thing in your hand and got up, rose up out of your bed, and you faced your son. And you brought him to that center, and
by force, yes.
Yeah. But he had a force, and you had a force. You were not without energy. He saw that, and he was not without. He came with energy. So you had the power in that you were taking care of yourself, and he was trying to take care of himself for getting some money. Without any trouble, and you somehow worked it out to bring it to the center. And this opposition in all things is a glorious thing, just like you said in Nephi and in the scriptures, that the thing that I find very powerful is that all things must be a compound in one. And that element of you with your son and you with your daughter were not compounds. It was, in order for it to be a composition, it had to be both of you working at it together.
True.
And the other thing that I got this morning, yesterday, the first meeting, was meditation in this manner of trying to make young people realize it's a mistake to leave the church, that we can work this out. And this person in meditation is working that way with young people to try to get them to not look at just the bad of the church or the extremes, but for the parent or for the other person who thinks they're righteous and they have it all right, both of them become not a polarizing thing, but there is that theme of moving together to accomplish a whole that both benefit by. And that's what I've gotten from this sunstone. And you're a part of that thinking.
And the last thing is that you go across that perspective, and from being out here, and you cross into the center, and that gives energy, that gives light, and no one person has more than the other. So it really is a work of art to work with a tremendous tragic problem in our homes, in with relationships. And if we can take that analogy of your circle and the center and the evil or the bad or the dark here and the beauty and the light, they're, neither of them are good until they come together. And that's the glorious thing about opposition in all things. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.
And whatever anyone else has to say to what I have to say or to make it more meaningful.
One comment I would make about what you had to say is I agree that opposition in all things is a glorious concept. We all need to remember that it's a dangerous concept, extremely dangerous concept. We can create much joy, much meaning, and even more important, consciousness and awareness in our lives by working with that concept of opposition. But it is a two-edged sword. Just as we can cut into the darkness and become more enlightened and more understanding and more appreciative of life, we can also injure if we have the wrong perspective and try to force ourselves on
it. It takes real skill and training.
It's an art, I agree with you.
And a lot of the problem in the church today is we have these laws that are set, and everyone who's battling these laws have not had the gift of going beyond to learn to work through that, but just to come to that point of seeing the law but not working through.
It's definitely an art. I think our culture has influenced the church to the point of where we try to make a science or a list of rules or a list of behaviors out of things and solve our problems that way. And you realize that as I say this, I'm getting very nervous because I know after pontificating here in the next few days, I'm going to get a chance to be humbled again. So I'm a little nervous about it. The Lord has always been very attentive to me in that respect. I get so proud, and he says, "Hey, how about this? Try this on." So, but yes, it's a fascinating thing. I think life would not be so wonderful and so joy producing if it didn't have an element of danger and risk to it. It would be pretty darn boring. I don't know if everyone feels that way, but personal opinion. I appreciate, maybe that's why I'm in the stock market, doing that every day. That's a very good reminder. Are we done?
So, one more question then.
I totally believe in opposition in all things. That's absolutely a foundation that I carry with me at all times. My mom, though, believes that I am the opposition in all things. And I wish I could say that, and it would be totally hilarious, and it would be lighthearted, but it's absolutely not. My mom and I butt heads all the time. I'm at the point where I know what I want to be happy, and I know how to get there, and I'm on that path, but my mom sees it as something that's very threatening to her. She wants something completely different for me, and I don't know how to go about helping her realize that it's okay because I'm happy. I don't have to be her.
Yes, and it brings me back to that comment I made about my home teachers when I said that if he could find a way to realize that he's the one with the issues, he has this perspective of what his daughter's husband should be, that's his issue. You can't tell your mother that's only going to make her worse, most likely. But if you can find a creative and loving way to bring that to her attention, a story, a heartfelt letter from you, saying, I feel for you, Mom, that you feel that you have to have this burden when it's really mine. You know, something like that may help to, you have to find what's right for you and find a way to get to that. But yeah, I think it's something you look for a loving, creative, kind, eye-opening way rather than a confrontational way to bring that issue up with your mother. Good luck. Thank you all.